pray together. Our Father, it is absolutely true that we are lost without you. Apart from you, we go on our way, on our own way, trying to make life work. Apart from you, we are lost. Apart from you, we can't make sense out of life and the things that are happening around us. But with you, we experience a kind of humble, grateful confidence that you are working all things to the end that you have in store for us. So as we open your word this morning, give us eyes to see you more clearly and see a little bit more of how you work, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Good morning. Super Bowl Sunday. Hey, I want you to know, we're not one of these churches that cancels Sunday night church for the Super Bowl. All right? We canceled a long time ago. Anyway. Hey, by the way, the deacons are looking for a few good men to help in various aspects of service around the church. If you know of someone that we should be considering out at the commons area, there's a brochure that tells you about deacons, what they do, and it has a way for you to suggest somebody's name, and we'll make sure that it gets to the deacons for consideration. So thank you for that. You know, one of the most common questions of people inside the church and outside the church, kind of the big question that came up last Tuesday night in our roundtable, the question goes something like this: if God is so good and if God is so powerful, then why does he let bad things happen in the world? Why does he let bad things happen to good people? You heard that question before? You probably asked that question. If God's really in charge, then why do people have to deal with so much disappointment and tragedy? I mean, why doesn't God just stop bad things from happening? Why didn't he stop planes from flying into buildings? Why didn't he stop earthquakes in Haiti? Why does he let crazy leaders destroy millions of innocent lives? Why didn't he just stop them? And if God is in control, since we're on the subject, why does God let so many bad things happen to me? I mean, I know I'm not great, but I'm not bad. I'm not that bad. So why do bad things happen to me? Or sometimes we look at other people and we go, why them? Why does God let that happen to them? Well, we're going to be jumping into a story this morning, the end of Genesis, chapters 37 to 50. The story of Joseph is probably one of the best places in all of the Bible to address this question. If you're just joining with us, what you'll find Sunday after Sunday is we normally are going through, studying our way through entire books of the Bible or long sections of Scripture, and so we're beginning a sermon series in the life of Joseph, but it's actually the end of a study in the book of Genesis that we began several years ago. But this study will help us get our mind around this big question. And I say help us because, there are no simple answers to the why question. There's no answer to the question that'll make us all stand back and go, oh, I see now. Now I feel so much better about the disaster and disappointment I see in the world. Now, there's no answer that'll bring us to that point, but there are answers that need to factor in and shape the way we live our lives, as we'll see. Now, those of you who are somewhat familiar with the story of Joseph, I want to say right up front that this story is about much more than a mistreated young man who rises from rags to riches or pit to palace or tragedy to triumph. It's about way more than that. Because the true hero of this story, as in all the individual stories of the Bible, the true hero is God. And we need to focus our attention on him. What he is doing, why he is doing it. I'm convinced that Joseph had some kind of understanding that he was living in God's story. He believed that. He hung on to that, as we'll see as the story progresses. Even though he could not have made much sense out of how the storyline in his life was unfolding. Did you catch that? He understood something of the fact that he was living in God's story, but he did not could not make sense out of how the storyline was unfolding until the end. I think that's very important. Because when we start reading in Genesis 37 in a moment, you need to understand we are entering a story that's already in progress. In Act 1, in Genesis 1 and 2, we're told that God created a very good world to show us that He was and is a very good God. And in the beginning, everything was very good because people enjoyed both the presence of God and the provision of God. God provided people with everything that they needed to live in friendship with Him. But early on, we see that when given the choice, people desired to write and live out their own stories rather than live into God's story. That's what sin is, by the way, writing and living your own story rather than living into God's story. And as soon as people make that choice, when they go their own way rather than God's way, they make a royal mess out of everything. Act 2, Genesis 3 through 11, paints a picture of a world that is spiraling out of control, a world full of jealousy and hatred and violence and oppression and injustice, a world living in total disregard of God, a world that God sees, and His commentary on the hearts of people is, I see that every thought and intention in the heart of people is on evil continually. Now, this is an important part of the answer to the big question, because you see, the world we're living in today is not the world that God created. It's not the very good world that God created. It's the world we created when we thumbed our nose at God and decided to live for ourselves rather than for Him and with Him. So all the bad stuff we see happening in the world today, none of it was a part of God's original intent for the world. But God has chosen, at least for a time, to leave the world as it is, people making choices for Him or against Him, and for the most part, letting the consequences of those choices stand. So we live in a world today where good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people, but also sometimes bad things happen to good people, and sometimes good things happen to bad people, which makes everything very, very confusing. That's the crazy, messed up world that we created. Back to Genesis. Well, God, because He loves us, He didn't want to leave us to destroy ourselves. And so He comes to a man named Abram, which later he changes his name to Abraham, and he's the leader of, or the father of, three great world religions, Judaism, Islam, Christianity. And God chooses Abraham and makes a covenant promise with him. Basically, God says, I'll bless you, I'll bless your family, and through your family, I'll bless the whole world. Specifically, through one of Abraham's descendants, Jesus, He will set the world right again. His kingdom will come and be set up on earth, and God will bless and live among people of every tribe, every tongue, every nation, just as God intended from the beginning. That's the promise. And this promise is passed from Abraham and his son Isaac and his son Jacob. And yes, the stories of these men that we looked at in earlier parts of the story, they teach us important lessons about what it means to live by grace through faith. And these men learn to trust in the promise of God in the midst of all kinds of personal setbacks and failure and things being set against them. But again, they're not the main focus of the story. God is the main focus. He's the hero. And in all of their stories, what we see is that God is faithfully keeping His promises through all kinds of circumstances that seem to put the promise in jeopardy. That's the big idea of Act 3 in the story. How God works to move His promise forward in this crazy, messed up world where everything, including God's own people, opposed Him and opposed the good that He wants for them. This is important. This is the whole storyline of the Old Testament. How God is faithfully moving His promise forward in a world, a crazy, messed up world, where everything, including God's own people, opposed Him and the good that He wants for them. That's the storyline
of the First Testament. Well, when we pick up the story in Genesis 37, we have seen God working in the lives of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, keeping and remaining faithful to keep His promises, even when they were unfaithful. And we're going to see some of these themes emerge in the story of Joseph. And the key question that's laying on the surface of the text is, how is God going to bless this crazy, messed up, hillbilly, redneck family? I mean, how is He going to do that? I mean, and even more than that, I mean, how is God going to bring blessing through this family that's on the brink of self-destruction? Well, take your Bible and turn to Genesis 37. Go ahead and open it there, but then put your finger in it or your note-taking outline and then close it, because I want to read you the story. These stories were originally heard, not read, and so I want you to hear it, but then you can open it back up to take notes when we dig back in. Also, I want to encourage you to read the entire Joseph story many, many times in the next several weeks, because it will help you to keep the end in mind as we move through the details, as we'll talk about in a moment. Verse 1, Jacob lived in the land of his father Abraham and Isaac, sojournings in the land of Canaan. Now, these are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's third and fourth wife, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any other sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all the brothers, they hated him and couldn't speak peacefully to him. Now, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said, "Here's a dream that I dreamed. We were all binding sheaves out in the field, and then my sheaf rose up and stood upright. And your sheaves, they gathered around mine and bowed down." And his brothers said, "Are you really saying you're going to reign over us? Are you really saying you're going to rule over us?" And they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now, then he dreamed another dream, and he told it to his brothers and said, "Hey, I've had another dream. This time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me." And when he told that dream to his father and his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What's this dream that you dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come and bow ourselves to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept these things in mind. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Aren't your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? I'm going to send you to them." And he said, "Okay." And he said, "Now go see if it's well with your brothers and bring me a report." So he went to the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields. And the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" He said, "I'm seeking my brothers. You tell me where they're pasturing their flock?" And the man said, "Oh, they've gone away. I heard him say they were going to Dothan." So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. Well, the brothers saw him from afar, and before he came near, they conspired against him to kill him. They said, "Here comes that dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of these pits, and we'll say a fierce animal has devoured him, and we'll see what becomes of his dreams now." And when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, "Let's not take his life." Reuben said, "Shed no blood. Throw him into that pit in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him." Because Reuben was thinking he would come and rescue him out of their hand and restore him to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe and this robe of many colors that he wore. And they took him and threw him into a pit. And the pit was empty. There's no water in it. So it must have hurt when it hit the bottom. And they sat down to eat. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, and their camels bearing gum and balm and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said, "I tell you what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him. He is our brother, after all, our very own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. And the Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up, lifted him out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and so they took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph wasn't in the pit, he tore his clothes and he returned to his brothers. "The boy is gone, and what's going to happen to me?" He was the firstborn, and he was responsible. And then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped it in blood. And then they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "We found this coat. Please identify whether it's your son's robe or not." And Jacob identified it, said, "It's my son's robe." Evidently, a fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces, and Jacob tore his garments and put on sackcloth and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, and he said, "No, I'll go down to Sheol to my son in mourning." And so his father wept for him. And meanwhile, the Midianites had sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. Wow. Now, let's go back to verse 2. Every major section in Genesis is introduced by what we see in verse 2. This is the account of, or this is the generations of. There were no chapters in Genesis when it was originally written, and this is the way the book naturally breaks down. This is the marker. These are the generations of Adam. These are the generations of Noah. These are the generations of Abraham, of Isaac. These are generations of Esau. These are the generations of Jacob, which is actually the story of Jacob's children. That's important. The story of Jacob's children. Jacob, verse 3, is the same as Israel, same name. His name was changed. And all these stories were told to the children of Israel as they were making their way back from slavery in Egypt and to the land that God promised their forefathers. These stories were their heritage. These stories were their family history, and these stories shaped their identity as a people, as God's people. And in each of these major stories, the stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all these stories had a different angle, a different slant on how God kept His promises to these people, because the whole idea was, if you can see how God kept His promises in the past, you can trust Him to keep His promises in the future. Now, when you read the Bible, you need to realize that the first audience of these stories, again, as I said, they didn't read the stories, they heard the stories. And they heard them, and they reheard them. And it's just like, you know, when your family is sitting around at a meal and somebody goes off telling stories, you know how that goes. I mean, we do this in our family, you know, a couple of times a year, and everybody be sitting around, and one of the kids will say, "Hey, you remember when we were at Jason's Deli, and we were standing in line ordering lunch, and the lady behind the counter asked Dad what he wanted for lunch, and he said, yeah, a chicken salad sandwich and a croissant." And everybody laughed. Well, I took French. I mean, croissant. That's the way you say it. You don't say croissant the way you do in the South. I mean, you gotta have a little dignity. Everybody laughs. Or they'll say, then they go on to the next story. "Hey, remember the time that we were living in Little Rock and it snowed 15 inches and Dad got out and tried to use the water hose to melt the snow off the driveway? He even hooked it up to the hot water heater, for goodness sake. I mean, he grew up in Florida. He knows nothing about snow. And you know what happened? There was a giant block of ice at the bottom of the driveway, so big that when we tried to get our little Datsun V210 over, all the kids, Karen included, had to get in the back end of the wagon just to get it up over. I mean, and they all laugh and laugh. And personally, I don't think either story is that funny. You got family stories like that, stories when they're told and retold. Everybody is waiting for the punchline, and all the details, the more the details, the juicier they are. I mean, remember the Thanksgiving when Mom almost poisoned us? You know, you got stories like that. Some of you are still in therapy for them. But as you tell those stories and you go through the familiar parts, you know that each part is building up to the punchline. Well, how much more with the family history of God's people? As these stories were told and retold, and as you read them and reread them, you see big themes emerging. And the one that is hammered home in the book of Genesis is how God is moving His story forward, keeping His promises to individual people, messed up people, and somehow, someway, now to a whole family that's on the brink of self-destruction. And that's the first thing we find in this story in verses 1 through 11, we see a family poised to self-destruct. And you see it in the favoritism that is showed to Joseph, and you see it in the subsequent hatred for Joseph. Look at it. Verse 3 says that Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he was the son of his old age. What does that mean? Well, Jacob had two wives, Rachel and Leah, and he had two girlfriends, Bilhah and Zilpah, which is a weird story in and of itself. But Joseph is 17 years old. He's his father's favorite son because he was the firstborn son of his favorite wife. Now, there's family history here because Jacob should have known better because he was on the receiving end of favoritism when he grew up. His father, Isaac, clearly preferred his older, manly man, hunting buddy, brother, Esau, and he clearly preferred him. So Jacob grew up lacking the love and affirmation of his father, and he lived and fought against that father wound all his life. And now he's making the same mistake. He's doing to his children the same thing that was done to him by his father. Now, you think there's a lesson in that? Sin runs in families. Unchecked sin passes from one generation to the next. That's clear in the story. That's not what the story's about, so we won't camp there. The symbol of his favoritism was this robe of many colors, verse 3. I was able, through all of my study and research, to dig up a relief found in Egypt of this coat of many colors. There it is. Actually, we don't know what the coat looked like. This is one of those words that's only used one time in the Bible. It could have meant coat of many colors. It might mean long-sleeved garment. But most scholars are in agreement that it symbolized a royal garment or the kind of coat that was worn by someone in management, someone who didn't have to work. And you can see something of that in how Joseph's brothers are working, but he's not working. He's the one his dad sends to go check on the other brothers. Joseph is management. The brothers are labor. And there's no question Jacob is lavishing money on Joseph in a way that he doesn't the other children, and he's lavishing a position of status on him not granted to the other children. And Joseph is the apple of Jacob's eye, but even more, he's the idol of his heart. The central source of joy and love in his life is this boy, Joseph, and that poisoned the whole family with hatred, which is the second thing that we see in this story and the progressive disintegration of this dysfunctional family, and that's the brothers' hatred. Favoritism, hatred. They're linked. And the hatred is mentioned three times, verse 4, 5, and 8. The brothers hated Joseph because of his favored status, and they hated him because of the dreams. It's interesting, all through the story, you'll see dreams coming up in this story. Dreams always come in pairs. And Joseph has two dreams here, one agricultural and one astronomical. His first dream, he and his brothers are binding up heaps of wheat out in the field, and Joseph's bundle stands up straight, and the brothers' bundles come around him and bow down, telling men who already hate you that, you know, because your dad has given you status above them, telling me you had a dream where they bow down to him. Well, that's not going to go over too well, and it didn't. And they're like, you're joking. You're telling us that you think we're going to bow down to you. I don't think so. And it says they hated him all the more for his dreams and his words, which may be the content of the dream, but it may be the way he told it to them, how he carried on about it. I don't know. And then to make matters worse, he has a second dream in verse 9 where the sun and moon and stars, 11 stars, bow down to him. And what does he do? He goes right back and tells them again. Now, this is important. The text doesn't say that Joseph did anything wrong here. In fact, all through the story, no fault is charged directly to him. And a lot of commentators and a lot of preachers have a lot of fun with this. And they say, hey, he's 17, he's a teenager, he's his father's favorite. He wears his favoritism on his sleeve. He's the one who checks on the brothers and tells them all the bad stuff. I mean, at worst, he's a spoiled, snot-nosed little brat. At best, he's just plain stupid. I mean, if you go babbling to your brothers about a dream where they bow down and worship you as king, and they despise you so much that they can't stand the sight of you, why would you run back and tell them a second dream that says, hey, I'm really not just the king, I'm the center of your universe? But you know, we can have some fun with that, but the text just tells us that the brothers hated him. It doesn't say he did anything wrong, and it says that his father is put out with him. Verse 10, his father rebukes him as a strong word. Why? What's the big deal? Why don't people just write it off to bad goat meat that he ate the night before? Well, when we step into the Bible story, we're stepping into a different culture. That culture was hierarchical and patriarchal. And one of the things that was iron law in the society of that day is that the younger always bows to the older. Younger bows to the older. It's never the other way around, but that also means that children always bow to their parents. It's never the other way around. So the reason that the brothers are outraged and the father is beside himself is because in that culture, what Joseph is telling them, it's not just some smart aleck kind of thing that he happened to dream up. It's because Joseph is telling, what he's telling them is totally improper, outrageous, impossible, and hatred and resentment and jealousy and violent bitterness is growing in this family, and it's going to blow the top off of every one of their lives. That's what we see in the first 11 verses. A family ready to self-destruct. And the question laying on the top of the text is, how in the world will God bring blessing to and through this crazy, messed up family? Well, we begin to get a little bit of an answer to that question in the second point here, in the second half of the story. The second thing we see in this story is God sovereignly working to bring His promises to pass. And we see that first in the dreams, and then second we see it in the details of the story. And we're going to talk about the dreams throughout the whole study, but in the terms of the dreams, these dreams are God's way of telling us right up front that He is working to bring salvation to this family in a way that turns the values of the world upside down. He is going to work in a very, very strange, upside down kind of way. And through these two dreams, God is revealing that He's going to work in a very specific way through Joseph to bring His purposes to pass. But we also see something of how God works in the details of the story. Details that you might read in the story and think, oh, that's just coincidence. Oh, that's just chance. Oh, that's just filler material. Now, when Jewish people wrote, there's no filler. There are no wasted details. Every word matters. And so when you get to a section that you leave just kind of scratching your head going, what is that about? Why tell me that? Then you need to understand that there's something else going on there. Look at verse 12. Verse 12 tells us Jacob decided to send Joseph to check on his brothers who are grazing their herds in Shechem. Now, everything that happens in these next couple of verses, you leave you scratching like, why are you telling me this? Out of everything you could tell me, you know, why are you telling me that the brothers were in Shechem, but they just happened to decide to move to Dothan? Shechem was about 50 miles from home, Dothan another 14 miles away, and so Joseph has to make this long trip out in the wilderness by himself to find him. And then we're told in verse 15 that Joseph gets lost, and he's wandering. It just happens to get lost, and he's wandering around in the field, and it just so happens that a man finds him lost in the field, and the stranger just happened to overhear the brothers mention that they were moving on, and they just happened to mention that they were moving on to Dothan. And so Joseph just happens to catch up with them, and when the brothers see Joseph coming, they decide to kill him. But Reuben, the firstborn, the eldest son, just happens to be there to keep them from killing him. Maybe he was looking for a way to get back into his father's favor after the terrible thing that he did by sleeping with one of his father's girlfriends. I told you this is a crazy, messed up family. But Reuben, get this, Reuben just happened to be there to keep them from killing him, but just happened not to be there to keep him from getting sold into slavery. And it just so happens at that particular time, a caravan comes along, and it just so happens that Judah's greed is greater than his hatred. And he says, hey, why kill the guy? He's our brother, I mean, our own flesh and blood. Let's sell him and make a profit off of him. And they strike a deal, and Joseph goes off to Egypt. And it just so happens that he ends up in Potiphar's house, which is exactly the place that he needs to be. Now why are all these seemingly insignificant details in the story. Because they're all signposts. They're all lights going, look! Look at how God is working. God is using all these things to get Joseph to Egypt. What's the big deal about that? If Joseph doesn't get to Egypt, everybody dies. Because a great famine is going to come. And God is working to put Joseph in a place where he will ultimately save the family from that famine. And again, to understand that, you got to keep the whole story in mind. It's just like when you watch A Beautiful Mind or The Sixth Sense or more recently, The Book of Eli. When you watch those movies, after you see the end, you can never watch the movie the same after that. You go back and you watch and you understand all of the details, how all the details lead up to the end. But you didn't understand that when you watched it the first time. The Joseph story is like that. It's a story that was told and retold, and you hear it and you rehear it. And you know it how it all turns out, so the details are woven together to make a very powerful point. Every single detail, every twist and turn, it's all important because God is getting Joseph to where he needs to be, because if Joseph doesn't get to Egypt, not only does the family die, but tens and thousands of other people will die in the famine, and the whole messianic line dies out, and then what would happen to God's promise of blessing? You notice there's no mention of God anywhere in the chapter, which is odd for the book of Genesis. God is never speaks. He isn't even referred to. I mean, yeah, you and I know that the dreams are from God, but the text doesn't tell us they're from God. But is God at work? Yeah. He seems to be totally absent, but under the surface, behind the scenes, God is managing every detail down to the minutest detail, and all the chaotic things and all the terrible things and all the coincidences. God is weaving all of it together for the salvation of this family and ultimately the salvation of the whole human family. I love how Tim Keller puts it. He says, God's wise, redeeming love is perfectly compatible with the terrible things that happen in the lives of the people he loves. God's wise, redeeming love is perfectly compatible with all the terrible tragedies that come into your life. This, what happens to Joseph? This is a good kid. Pretty much a good kid. And all these bad things happen to him. He's stripped and seized and thrown into a pit. These are terrible, violent words. Like stripped is to tear the skin off an animal. And to throw is not just it's not just I just tossed you a quarter or something. It's like to be thrown into a grave and abandoned. And we know from Genesis 42 that Joseph cries out and he begs his brothers not to kill him. He begs them not to abandon him. He cries out. He's screaming. And what are they doing? They're sitting there eating their lunch. Totally callous. Turn a deaf ear to Joseph. Totally ignore him. He's crying out. Nothing happens. God doesn't stop it. God doesn't intervene. But God uses it, weaves it together to get Joseph to the right place. And I hear you. I hear you. I hear your question. Your question is, okay, yeah, but did God cause all this or did God allow all this? Did God cause it or did he allow it? Well, actually, I think there's a problem with both words. The problem with saying that God caused it all is that it removes the brothers' free choice and kind of turns everything into a puppet show, like God's pulling the strings and making all the characters do things, evil things, which makes God responsible. God would be the cause of evil in that. I don't think that works. But if we say that God allowed it, that just seems to distract or detract from God's sovereignty. And it's almost like we feel like, well, we're going to use the word allow and not cause because we got God's reputation to defend here, and that doesn't seem right either. So if I say God caused it, that may be saying too much. If I say God allowed it, that might not be saying enough. It might be saying too little. I studied the book of Genesis, had the opportunity of studying under a man named John Walton, who's a professor at Wheaton and in postdoctoral studies, and John Walton wrote a commentary on the book of Genesis, and he offers us another way of thinking about all this. He talks about how sometimes he enjoys playing a game of chess with his computer. he says, since I'm not very good at chess, I usually find that the computer puts me into positions where I have to respond with certain moves, and yet those very moves lead inevitably to further the computer's strategy and ultimate victory. He says, I feel free to choose a move that furthers my game strategy, but I usually discover that my choices are not particularly good ones. If I inadvertently tried to make an illegal move, the computer doesn't allow it. If I make a stupid move, the computer makes me pay for it as it weaves my stupidity into its strategy. If I make a move with evil intent, the computer blocks it and usually uses it to its own advantage. Walton says, compared to God, we're like bad chess players competing against a computer. He says, there are differences, of course. God is not just in it to win, and God's moves are not mechanically programmed. In one sense, it can be said that when he wins, we win. He's driven by love and compassion, yet just as in the illustration, we can at times feel caught in the current of the events that surround us, not understanding how we can be winning when it feels so much like losing. Did you catch that? We can sometimes feel caught in the current of the events that surround us, not understanding how we can be winning when it feels so much like losing. When life seems to be going so terribly wrong, as it did for Joseph, it's difficult to see how a good and powerful God would cause or allow bad things to happen to good people. But we also know that God doesn't promise to shield us from all evil. So, does God cause or allow? Are you ever going to get around to the point? Okay. Perhaps, Walton says, we can begin by viewing the big picture rather than addressing individual cases. We know from the Bible story, Act 3, that God sustains a cosmos that temporarily accommodates the presence of evil. He grants evil a certain latitude with the sovereign confidence that even when it does its worst, he can outflank it. That he often chooses to outflank rather than prevent defines what we mean when we say he accommodates its presence. To return to the illustration of computer chess, the computer doesn't make me move one way or the other, but it limits my choices and sometimes forces my hand. It is absolutely in control of the game, even though I'm making independent choices. Whatever choices I make are powerless to hinder its strategy. He says, neither the word cause nor allow describes the computer's role in my moves. And so since I can't find a suitable word that describes the computer's role in my moves, it's only possible to describe the computer's role in the game. I make free choices, but it controls the game. I cannot even minutely divert its strategies, let alone defeat it. And I think Walton is onto something. He says the language of cause or allow doesn't sufficiently describe what's going on in God's story because neither word totally reconciles how God's story moves forward in the presence of evil in this world. But what is of utmost importance is to understand that God controls the game. God's written the story, and the end of the story is as certain as the beginning. What will happen in the future is as sure and certain as what has happened. The point, God is working to get Joseph in the right place, and he is so great, so sovereign, that whatever move that people make in the story simply move the story along to the predetermined end that God has in mind. And that means, here's where theology intersects your life, that means God can and is working through the most disappointing, tragic circumstances in your life to get you where He wants you to be, to get you to the right place, and nothing can stop Him. Back to the details. He was in charge when the brothers hated Him. He is in charge when Joseph, arrogantly, naively, whatever, what Joseph tells his brothers the dreams. He's in charge as their hatred grows. He's in charge as Joseph gets lost. He's in charge as the stranger finds him and gets him going back to the right place, which sounds like the wrong place. He's in charge as the brothers throw Joseph into the pit. He's in charge as Reuben doesn't pull off his plan to get Joseph out of the trouble that he's in. He's in charge as they callously turn a deaf ear to his cries. He's in charge as the caravan just so happens to come along. He's in charge as Judas suggests they make a profit off of him rather than kill him. He's in charge as Joseph gets Jacob gets the bad news and falls into a deep depression, and he's in charge when Joseph goes off to Egypt and ends up in Potiphar's house. Every single detail in the story, nothing happens by chance, and God outflanks every move the people in the story freely choose. God sovereignly uses all these things to bring about His purposes and keep His promise, the promise to bring up His plan of rescue to bless His people so they can be a blessing to all people. That's the takeaway from Genesis 37. Genesis 37 teaches us that God uses hatred, envy, betrayal, deceit, injustice, anger, violence, rejection, ridicule, unjust treatment to get you in the right place. And you see, here's the big idea. When you live into God's story, God plays for you, not against you. When you're living into God's story, He plays for you, not against you. That means that when anything or anybody does something to you seeking to harm you, God outflanks that move for your ultimate good and for the glory of His story. Of course, it goes without saying, you don't want to be on the other side of the board playing against God. You don't want to be God's opponent. You don't want to play against Him. You want God playing for you. When you live into God's story, no disappointment, no disaster, nothing done to you by anyone in your life, in your family, in your workplace, nothing done to you, coincidental details, detrimental details, nothing can keep God from working to get you to the right place, His place, and that is the best way to live your life. It's best to look at everything that happens in your life as the way that God is working to get you to the right place. Because in God's story, no one or no thing can make a move against God that puts the game in jeopardy. And that's clear at the end. So how do you live into a story like this? You live humbly, gratefully, and you trust. Humble, grateful, trust. Humble, God's God, you're not. Grateful, He's playing for you, not against you. Trust, He is working everything that comes into your life for His glory and your ultimate good. When you live into God's story, you can humbly, gratefully be confident that God is playing for you, not against you. Whenever you're living into God's story, no move made against you can derail you because no move can outflank God. If God is for us, who can be against us? Father God, what we need more than anything else is to have this perspective as soon as we leave these doors this morning, and let it carry us and shape us and govern us in every part of our lives. Holy Spirit, would You do this in us as we continue to try to live into Your story.